Okay, these are the words of Rabbi Amos Bunim and Rosh Hashiva Rabban Zatzal. When did you first meet Rabban in any capacity?
I met Rabban in 1943.
What was the circumstance?
I went to the davening the first Yom Kippur in Beis Medrash Kabbalah.
That was the first time they ever davened there?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay, that you went with your father.
First time they ever davened Yom Kippur there.
Uh-huh. So what was that like?
It was just the most magnificent feeling that anybody could ever have.
What was like, you were introduced to Rabban at that time?
Yes.
What was the introduction like?
Nothing. My father introduced me as his son.
What was your feelings during that introduction? 13
years old.
Hello?
13.
So you recollect that?
Yes, I do.
What was the first thing that you remember about him during that meeting?
I mean, I just remember a very godly person.
That's because your father told you about him, or because you saw it yourself?
It was what I expected and what I saw myself.
Uh-huh. And so you were there that Yom Kippur. Now, any experience?
There were only just a million of people there at that time.
Do you remember some of them, who they were?
What?
Who were they at the time?
I remember some of them. It was Rabbi Berkowitz was there at that time.
Are these people still living?
No.
Uh-huh. Okay, and this Rabbi Berkowitz was a Talmud of Rabbi Aaron?
Yes.
From Europe or from here?
My wife, Berg, was there at that time.
Uh-huh.
Not living anymore either.
Yeah.
Those were the people that were there.
Uh-huh. Okay, what other experiences did you have over the years with him that you remember?
Most probably the very most important contact I had was in 1955.
Yeah. And what did that consist of?
At that time, my father-in-law,
yeah,
Edward S. Silver, was a district.
Was who?
His name was Edward S. Silver.
Yeah.
He was a district attorney of Brooklyn.
Oh, I remember that.
Rabban called me and said that a number of families were in very big trouble, that they had come to America from Europe, and they had stolen gold, had brought in gold into America. And they were in very severe trouble with them. And he asked me if my father-in-law could intervene with the judge, and I told him that that was impossible, that my father-in-law could never do a thing like that in his position. So he said, then, I want you to go to talk to the judge and to ask for Rachmanis. Here I said to him, I argued with him for 15 minutes on the telephone.
Yeah.
And I told him that I'm all of 26 years old.
Yeah.
And that I was never in court in my life.
Yeah.
I don't know how court works even.
Yeah.
I'm not a lawyer. And he argued back with me back and forth for 15 minutes. Until finally I asked him, are you telling me this together, Das Torah and Emunas Chachamim?
Yeah.
And he said, yes.
Uh-huh.
So I said, then I have no choice. He said, that's right.
Uh-huh.
He said, but I want to tell you something.
Yeah.
You should always remember for the rest of your life that whatever you do, if you go with MS, you will always succeed.
So I
asked him who the judge was, and he told me that it's a judge that was sitting here temporarily by the name of Judge Lynch from Alabama, and that I can't even get an appointment with him because he's here on a temporary basis without his secretary. So, I mean, everything was absolutely, the odds were tremendously against me, maybe a million to one odds against my being able to succeed in this kind of a situation.
Yeah.
I walked up the steps of the federal court, and I realized how many families, the achrayas was on my shoulders, that the yeshiva was on my shoulders, for all these families, and I began to cry, and I walked up the steps of the federal court, St. Tillam, that was downtown.
Yeah.
And I went over to the information booth, and I said that I would like to speak to Judge Lynch, and he said he has no secretary, you can't speak with him. The only thing you could do is go on the sixth floor, room 612, knock on the door, and if he answers the door, then you could speak. I did that. I knocked on the door. He came out from three empty rooms inside, opened the door himself. He said, can I help you?
Yeah.
I said to him, I am here representing the Chief Justice of Jewish Law.
Uh-huh.
And he asked me, who is the Chief Justice of Jewish Law?
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, Rabbi Aaron Kotler.
Yeah.
Where does he reside? I said, in Lakewood, New Jersey. What does he do? I said, he is the head of one of the most significant and important seminaries in the entire world.
Yeah.
In political seminaries.
Yeah.
He said, come in.
Yeah.
Came in. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu put words into my mouth, and I said to him, Judge, I just want you to know that I am an American. I love democracy. I love freedom. I love everything that America stands for.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to understand that these people came from Europe, from the concentration camps, mm-hmm. and they had lived through a world that had no respect for human life. How could they have respect for human law?
Mm-hmm.
One human being could kill another human being without any feeling mm-hmm. for life and respect for life. How could they have respect for law?
Yeah.
And he said that, I don't know if I could help you, but I'm leaving on Friday. If the case comes up for Friday, I don't know what will happen. And at any rate, I just want you to go down to the head of the probation department and ask to speak to the head. And give this full feeling that you expressed to me
mm-hmm.
into and then he should put it into the report.
Yeah.
Which I thanked the judge, and I left, and I went down to the probation department, and the head of the probation department was out that day, and I said that the judge sent me, and he told me that if I can't find the head of the probation department, I should come back and talk to the judge, and he'll take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
He told me, no, don't go back to the judge. Because in federal court, the judge is on a higher, most high level here, and we don't want anybody to intervene
mm-hmm.
with us. So we'll find him for you.
Mm-hmm.
Where they found him, he was home in Queens, and he came running back into his office.
He came back?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave him the full story that I had given to the, that I had related to the judge, and he put it into the report. Friday morning was the sentencing,
mm-hmm.
and all the families were there. It was a terrible scene to see all those families.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sitting in the back of the court, and the judge got up with a tremendous tirade against them, and said that what they had violated is everything, every law that America stands for, that it's a horrendous crime to do this against our country. And he went on with a very severe diatribe against these people.
Mm-hmm.
And my heart was sinking deeper and deeper as he went on.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, after about 12 minutes of this diatribe, he got up and he said, but, and then he read the full thing that I had dictated to the probation department.
Mm-hmm.
And said that these people cannot be judged in the same way that we judge Americans, because so on so forth, as with the report that I had given him. And he said, therefore, under the circumstances, sentence suspended. And I ran up to go and thank the judge. And I did not even know or realize that for the federal court, you can't go up to the judge unless you get permission from the bailiff.
Uh-huh.
So as I'm walking up towards the judge, the bailiff stopped me and said, you have no right to go up there.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, the judge saw what was happening. He waved me on. We shook hands, did not say one word
mm-hmm.
between us, but we understood what the handshake, what mm-hmm. I meant to him and what he meant to me.
Mm-hmm.
I ran out and I called Rabban to tell him what happened, and I thought that the person of Rabban would jump through the telephone with joy.
Yeah.
So male simcha that you can't imagine.
You felt that over the phone?
Over the phone.
Mm-hmm.
People told me in Lakewood,
yeah.
There was never a Shabbos like that Shabbos that was with such simcha that Rabban had.
That was Friday afternoon?
Yeah.
Do you remember who told you that?
No, that I know.
Uh-huh. That's a Valdik Ismaisa. Now, how did he know about these people?
These people, I don't think they were intimate with him. I think they just came to him for help. And this, I learned a number of lessons from him.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, I learned what his life was, that really the individuals are so important mm-hmm. life. As much as you're doing for Klal, you have to worry about each and every individual and be concerned for each and every person.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was what was involved in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I understood what it means now, Das Torah Emunas Chacham, which of course he never said to me, I said to him.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, and when I had made the hesed for my father,
yeah.
at Shloshim.
Yeah. When was that?
That was in January of 1981.
Uh-huh.
And when I came to the yeshiva to make the shloshim, make the haskara for the shloshim, Rabbi Shneur said to me,
yeah.
"I want to tell you something. That this it's Bein Hasdarim, and when very big Rosh Yeshiva come here, and they make espadim haskaras, then." If they speak more than 10 minutes, people walk out on the biggest Rosh Hashanah.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, by the way, what are you going to talk about? So I said, I'm going to talk about what America looked like before Rabaran came. Talk about what America looked like when Rabaran came and what the relationship with my father was with Rabaran
mm-hmm.
and Hatzalah. He says, I'm going to speak about that. You can speak as long as you want.
Uh-huh.
But he says, I want you to tell that story about with the judge.
Uh-huh.
I said to him, I can't.
All right.
I can't tell a story like that in first person.
Uh-huh.
So he said to me, I insist that you tell the story.
Yeah.
I said, Rosh Hashiva, I can't.
Mm-hmm.
He said, then tell it in third person, but I insist that you do it.
Mm-hmm.
He had no choice. At any rate, the story had nothing to do with the Haskara, so I put it at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So I spoke for 50 minutes.
50?
50.
Wow.
And there was not one person that was, there were 1,300 people in the Beis Medrash.
Mm-hmm.
Not one person moved. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
There was, and he sent me up a note
mm-hmm.
to please don't forget the story.
Uh-huh.
I thought I was going to finish without the story. And the people in the Beis Medrash got so upset, they thought that he sent me up the note to stop speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very upset. But at any rate, I did tell the story, and afterwards I asked them in the Beis Medrash what really made them so, with such feeling that they wanted me to go on, that they didn't want me to stop speaking.
Mm-hmm.
They were so upset, and they told me that...
You remember who they were?
No, it was a whole group, I don't remember.
Yeah.
And they told me that they never realized what the struggles were for Torah in America.
Wow.
And therefore they learned something tonight
mm-hmm.
that really expressed and to them what America was really all about. It was so
mm-hmm.
important to them that they were really glued to their seats.
So these were like younger lives?
Yes, some of them were not so young. They were 30 and 40 year old people as well.
Well, 30, 40 is still out of that era a little bit.
That's right.
Right. Yeah.
They were really totally taken aback by that.
Very good. Very good. Any more?
It was a hesped that was got it taped.
Mm-hmm. They have it
on the.
Yeah, I'll have to look for it.
What?
I'll have to look for it.
And there was no tape that they told me in Lakewood that ever sold like that.
Uh huh. I'm surprised I didn't know about it. I'm surprised I didn't know about it because I was there then.
They have it in Lakewood that day.
Mm-hmm. I looked for it.
It's a tremendous husband.
Mm-hmm. Any other encounters that you could recall?
A lot.
Okay, as much as you can. I'm sitting here waiting.
Well,
in a short time, of course.
Of course, after that, I had run the first major dinner for Torah Masorah.
Mm-hmm. How did that come about?
1956, with Joe Kamenetsky, and asked me,
mm-hmm.
because Torah Masorah was really very difficult to get off the ground at
mm-hmm.
that time. And he asked me if I could please see if I could really do something unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked day and night to make this a success.
Mm-hmm.
Baruch Hashem, there was almost 800 or 1,000 people at that first dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to the 100 people or less that they had at all their other dinners.
Uh-huh.
So, and I was sitting next to Rabbi at that dinner.
Yeah.
And my father was on one side, and my Baron on the other side.
I think it's a picture of that.
Yes, picture. It's a very famous picture.
Yeah.
And the Baron asked me, said to me that I see that this ribbon dinner is so successful. Could you please do the same thing for Chinefetz? We need it as well.
Yeah.
I told Rosh Shiva that I can't do it the same year because I got all these people to come.
Yeah.
And I can do it for next year. And he said, remember that I'm counting on you to do it for next year.
Yeah.
I did. And that dinner was also
1051.
A success.
Well, 50, what year was that?
57.
That was the first Chinefetz party dinner?
No.
Oh.
But none of the dinners before that were really not very successful.
Was that the dinner where Rabbi Soloveitchik was?
Yes.
I mean, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Do you remember what happened there during that dinner? Some incident?
I remember one thing that is very interesting.
Yeah.
That Yeshabel, which I have his speech printed in my book. I don't know if you ever saw it.
No, unfortunately, I haven't seen the books because I'm not a good reader.
You want the books back, then you'll see a lot about the Baron.
Okay, I understand that, but I need live material.
Well, at any rate, Yashibir made a masterful speech about why he was there and what his feelings are about the Baron.
Yeah.
And as he was speaking, the Baron was pulling his jacket, saying, "Nein, nein, das ist nicht der Mann, nicht der Mann."
What, was too complimentary, is that it?
It was not, the Baron couldn't take all these compliments back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Accolades.
Yeah.
And anyway, it was a tremendously successful dinner.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't know if I was there. I think my dinner was 56 and that dinner was 57.
Okay, that's accurate enough. Yeah, okay, what other counters we had?
Then he used to call me for to go with him to different people for money for the yeshiva.
Mm-hmm.
And one day he called me and he said there was a man from Klutz in the coat suit business.
Yeah. Excuse me.
And if I could please meet him at the man's office, because he knew him from class, and he was a very wealthy man. I don't know if he was from anymore, but he, the Baron, knew him and wanted me to go with him, which I never said no.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I went with him, and the man was insulted and humiliated Rav Baron to such an extent, he called him that a person that you're bringing the archaic world to America. We don't want it in America.
Was the man from Klutz himself?
Yes.
He was European.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
We don't want it in America. This is archaic, atavistic, and doesn't belong in America. And all you're doing is bringing up parasites.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he went on and on for 10 minutes, one insult after another.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, I got up after 10 minutes and I said to the man, I said, "How dare you speak to the Chavetz Chaim of our generation the way you're speaking?"
Yeah.
And I said, "You had the schus to know in Europe all the Gedalim, Shemishkop, Baruch Be'er, Chaim Ozer, the Chavetz Chaim." I said, "I'm an American, I never had the schus to see those people."
Yeah.
"And I don't understand how a person who saw those carters."
Yeah.
"Could speak with such disrespect to the Gadol Hadar."
Uh-huh.
At any rate, we walked out. The Baron took me by the hand and said to me, "You were concerned for the wrong person." I said, "How could you say that, Rosh Hashanah? It was covered on Torah."
Yeah.
"The man was insulting you." He says, "Because," he says, "I am Michael and my cover."
Yeah.
That should not bother you, my cover.
Uh-huh.
"But the man did not have the schus to give money for Torah. That's what should have bothered you, not my cover."
And that wasn't just a melitza. That was really what he meant deep down.
That's right. He really meant that.
Yeah, he never said, "I don't know, but he had the midas, that's the midas of Emes."
Right.
Of course, that came through two times. Very important to know that. It wasn't just... There's a rabbi I met who told me a similar story, but another gvir like that from Europe. It was a glazier. Remember such? This is Rabbi Shapiro told me this.
No.
You know who Rabbi Shapiro is?
No.
He's from Queens. He used to be in East Flatbush.
No, I know Rabbi Shapiro.
He used to be in the hospital.
Yes.
Yeah. So he told me something similar with a glazier.
Yeah.
And also, he told me a similar story like that. He came there and he said, he also was, the punchline of that story was that this man was saying, we don't need yeshivas, we don't need this, and he says, my ankle is not from the yeshivas. And he gave him $50 and goodbye. So he told me that this man's great grandson is now learning in Hebron and is a Mitzvah in Hebron Yeshiva.
Uh-huh.
The same man who said, "Who needs yeshivas?"
Yeah.
He just happened to meet the boy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else?
And you might want to see his honesty when they made the advertisements in the booklets for the new building that they were building at that time.
Uh-huh.
And they put trees there.
Yeah.
In front of the building. And the Byron said they have to take that away because that's not Emmett, there's no trees there.
Yeah. I know, but it's not standard architectural drawings.
Yeah, but he wouldn't allow it.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. He said it's not Emmett.
Right.
You know how far that he went with Emmett.
Uh-huh.
But anyway.
Yeah.
The next experience was with the biggest builder in Queens.
Yeah. Was that Left Rack?
Yes.
Oh, I don't know. I'm sorry. We
had an appointment at 11 o'clock.
Yeah. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
At any rate, we had an appointment there at 11 o'clock, and it was 11, it was 12, it was 1.
Remember what year that was?
That was in 58. People were coming with boards and ladders. We were sitting in the waiting room there.
Yeah.
And I had the greatest time of my life. I was sitting and talking and learning with the Rosh Hashanah.
Uh-huh.
But I said to him after 2 hours waiting in the waiting room, the Rosh Hashanah, I don't understand why Torah has to come with such fair cotton and bizyonos.
Yeah.
He took me by the hand. He says, I want to tell you something today. I never want you to forget what I'm going to tell you today.
Yeah.
There's a ton of Devela Eliyahu, which I subsequently
And
said that the day of the Shivrei Luchos, there was a Gzerim in Hashemayim.
Yeah.
That if it's real Torah, it's going to come with Tverkite and Bezionos, because that was part of the Shivrei Luchos.
Uh-huh.
Part of the Midas Hadin of the Shivrei Luchos.
Uh-huh.
He says, I'm happy on two counts. Number one, that I accept the Chazal. But number two, I now know that I'm working for Emes.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Okay, then what happened?
Nothing. We went in and we got money, but meantime, it was not a very pleasant situation because of the... keeping the Rosh Hashiva waiting.
Uh-huh. But he understood what it was about.
He understood that that's the Torah, that if you're working for Torah, that has to come as part of Torah.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he was trying to transmit to me in my life, that if I'm going to come across and work for Torah and people are going to do that to me, that I should understand that this is the way of Torah and never become discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he was trying to tell me. Anyway, I can go on and on.
But as long as you have time, I have time.
I'll just tell you two more stories.
Yeah, go ahead.
That I think will be very important.
Yeah.
One story of Hakaras HaTov that he taught me a lesson.
Yeah.
Very important lesson. He called me up one day in my office, which was around the corner from his office in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
His office was at 1133 Broadway.
What level is that? Where is that?
In Manhattan on 26th Street.
Uh-huh, okay.
He called me up one day and he said to me that he's very upset.
Yeah.
Can you please come up to his office?
Yeah.
I came up to the office and said, "Shiva, what's the matter?" He said, "I understand that there's a that Senator Homer Capehart."
What?
There's a Senator Homer Capehart in Indiana.
Yeah.
Who was running for re-election, and he got us very $380,000 for Senator Hatzmoy when we were in very difficult trouble through the Secretary of State, John Forster Dulles. He was very close to Dulles.
Who was?
Senator Homer Capehart.
Okay.
And he said that I understand that he's losing in the polls to Birch Bayh, who was a liberal, Kennedy liberal, and I want you to please call every rub in Indiana and tell him in my name that it's an Indian of Hakaras Hatov, and we have to get all the Jewish vote out for Senator Capehart. So I said, fine. I went back to my office and I started to call all the Rabbanim in Indiana. Each one was very upset with the call, because they said, how could you expect us to get the vote out for a reactionary conservative, which Capehart was, against the liberal that we are all liberal. We can't go against our principles of being a liberal. I said, but you're dealing here with the Gadol Hadar, whose principle is Hakaras Hatov, but you can't just take a liberalism over Hakaras Hatov, but they refused to listen.
Yeah. Yeah.
I came back to the office and I told Rabbi Aaron what had happened with each one of the Rabbanim. They all had the same
excuse.
And he sat me down and he started to yell at me, but not because he was upset with me, but because he wanted me to understand what Hakaras Hatov means, and he gave me a home musa, a slabatka musa shmus on Hakaras Hatov. And then he said to me, now I want you to please dial the phone, because he never allowed the secretary to call up and say Rabbi Kaufman was calling. So you just dial the phones and I'll get on the phone right away. But he said, that's not covered abrios for somebody else to intervene before I get on the phone. So I dialed the phone and he called every rabbi in Indiana himself. He told them that if you don't, he started to yell at them, and he said, if you don't understand what occurs, I told you, then you have no understanding of Torah. This is the fundamental of Torah, and you have no right to be a rabbi.
These are all Orthodox rabbis?
Yes. You don't have the right to be a rabbi, and you have no understanding what Torah is all about. He was very upset with them. Anyway, at any rate, I saw from him what the Union of Hakaras Hatov meant. I learned that, but also I learned here Hakaras Hatov for a guy, not only for Yid, but this was a guy that he didn't even know personally at how far Hakaras Hatov goes.
Now, but did he do it because he was the benefit, or he thought that you have to give Hakaras Hatov no matter who?
That's what he felt. It's an Union of Hakaras Hatov, no matter who, no matter what.
Even though, not considering the loss of profit or Zaytik issues.
Right. I mean, it wasn't Zaytik issues. He, the man did something good, and we owe him Hakaras Hatov.
Did he win?
He lost.
All right.
That was a very important lesson. The last story is probably the most important story.
Yeah, good.
I have to talk with my father. The story is on that tape in the Ascara that I made for
him.
The Vat Hatzalah, which of course was the organization that did all the Hatzalah work, that was founded by the Rosh Yeshiva in America through the efforts of Chaim Ozer. Made the American Rabbanim start this.
Chaim Ozer was, but he died right before the war, right?
Chaim Ozer died in 1940. August 1940. He had his Talmud, Rabbi Elazar Silver, who was then the president of the Gudetzer Rabbanim, who was a Talmud Muvak of his, and made him start this Vat Hatzalah to save the Yeshiva Welt. But of course, it expanded itself into saving all Yidden as time went on. But in 1944, it was the moment during those years that they worked for Hatzalah, they saved about 100,000 Jews. But 1944 was the moment that they were waiting for, November 1944.
Yeah.
When Sterrenbuchs in Switzerland, who represented the Rad Hatzalah in Switzerland, made contact with Mr. Musi, who was the president, the former president of Switzerland, fascist himself. And he told them that Mr. Himmler, Yimach Shemo, who was the head of the SS, wanted to make a deal to have money in Switzerland for after the war, that he would have a safe haven because he saw the Germans were going to lose the war. And therefore, after a very difficult and involved discussions with through the Sterrenbuchs with him, with the Mr. Musi with Himmler, they finally came to a deal that for every $17 that was deposited in Switzerland, he would save a year, and that the first deal would be for 300,000 Jews, which was a deal for $5 million. And he said, "I will show you my goodwill, and I will save 2 train loads from Bergen-Belsen for 1,680 Jews. And 1 train load from Theresienstadt for 1,210 Jews. And I will send them to Switzerland from the concentration camps, and you will see my goodwill before you give me any money." Which he did. And one of the people on the Bergen-Belsen train with the Satmar Rebbe. And also Rebbe Anderson Steifel. He then said to the Sterren, through Mr. Musi, "Now let the rabbi's group, that's what he called them, show me their goodwill and give me a deposit of $1,200,000. And it has to be deposited immediately to a Swiss bank. And, of course, at that time, it was a tremendous amount of money.
Yeah.
It's a lot of money today, but in those days, it was unheard of.
Right.
And they went all over the country to try to raise as much as they could, and they were able to raise $230,000. And they were short $970,000.
Yeah.
So, Baron made a very important decision at that time, that he would go to the head of the Joint Distribution Committee, Mr. Mo Levin. You have to understand that the Joint Distribution Committee was the secular Jewish organization in charge of Hatzalah. And they were against any illegal activities, extra-legal activities, bribes, ransom. They always want to go with the letter of the law rather than the pikuach nefesh and tochen. They didn't go with it. At any rate, Rabban called Mo Levin and made an appointment and went with my father to Mo Levin. And Rabban, of course, knew what his attitude was during the whole war, the entire war. He came to Mo Levin, and Mo Levin said to him, "Rabbi, I don't understand. Do you know that many of these people are apostates? Many of these people have converted. Many of these people are not from them, no relation to Yiddishkeit whatsoever. How do you, as a Rosh Hashiva, come and help them, try to save them?" Rabbi Aaron got very angry at him, fire in his eyes, and he said to him, "Well, Levitt, let me tell you something. I never want you to forget what I'm going to tell you, that Yisrael, Afapishachata Yisrael, who my job of a Rosh Hashiva is to save every single Jew, even if he sinned." Juxtaposition of the Rosh Yeshiva telling the secular, head of the secular Jewish organization, what has to be saved, and the secular Jewish organization had telling Rabaran, "Why are you saving these kind of people?" The juxtaposition of that was unbelievable.
So Mo Levitt was not from?
No, definitely. At any rate,
it's very important what you told me now, because some people wrote books accusing the firm of not saving other people.
I know, but if you read my book, you would see what, mm-hmm. what the whole story is, what happened.
Yeah.
At any rate, and incidentally, my book, everything is footnoted with every situation that happened, because there's nothing that I just took for granted anyway. So he said to Mo Levitt, they tell Mo Levitt the entire story, why he's there, what they would make, have a possibility of saving 300,000 Jews, and he wants to borrow $970,000, not asking him to give it to him, he can pay him back, and he has a chance to raise it, and therefore, could he please lend the $970,000? Said to a baron, you came to the wrong person. You know that we are against bribes. You know that we are against ransom.
Mm-hmm.
You know that we are against illegal activities. Mm-hmm. How do you come to me?
Mm-hmm.
So a baron turned to my father and said to my father, would you please answer him?
Mm-hmm.
My father said to him, I want you to know that if you don't lend us this money now, we will write a letter to every member of the Joint Distribution Committee and tell them that the blood of 300,000 Jews is on your hands and that you are responsible for spilling that blood.
Mm-hmm.
And we will close down your organization.
Mm-hmm.
And we will see to it that this, that your organization will never be able to go on.
Mm-hmm.
He saw that he meant business, and he said to Rabban, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll lend you the money, but on one condition, that you get a license from the State Department, which is the law, that when you're dealing with the enemy in a war situation, during war period of time, that you have to get a license to send money to the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get that license, I will lend you that money.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want you to tell you, Rabbi Kaufman, you will never get that license.
Mm-hmm.
The Baron answered him, I want you to know, Mr. Levitt, that if we have to tear the city of Washington apart, I will get that license. And he said to my father, let's go to Washington immediately.
Who said that?
The Baron said to my father.
Right.
So they went to the White House.
Mm-hmm.
They got an appointment with Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
And when Roosevelt had a way of always deflecting any one of these situations.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that I have a member of my cabinet, a Jew, Henry Morgenthau Jr.
Mm-hmm.
He takes care of all of these situations.
Mm-hmm.
And I will call him and tell him to expect you.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he called him and gave him a message not to do anything for these people.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, called them, and he did not want to help them.
Mm-hmm.
But so they went to Henry Morgenthau, to who was the Secretary of Treasury,
mm-hmm.
To try to persuade him to help them.
Mm-hmm.
And he, a baron, spoke Yiddish,
mm-hmm.
understood English,
mm-hmm.
but did not speak English.
Mm-hmm.
And he. He asked my father to tell Morgenthau what the situation was, and then he got up and he told Morgenthau how important it was in Yiddish,
mm-hmm.
to try to help the situation.
Mm-hmm. Were you there?
No, I was not there. Morgenthau then said to Rabban, asked my father to interpret, that how could you ask me, as a Jew, only Jew in the cabinet, to go and give money to the enemy when American boys are dying on the battlefield,
mm-hmm.
and how will I look to the American public?
Mm-hmm.
And the Baron realized that this was the moment of me yichya or me yamos,
mm-hmm.
either now or never, and he got up with burning eyes, and he said to Morgenthau in Yiddish, als sie will mich helfen zu raten den Jeden in der kritischen Zeit. Ihr seid wert gar nicht, eine Stelle ist wert gar nicht, ein jüdischer Leben ist wert mehr wie alle Stellen in Washington. And Morgenthau did not understand him. Turned to my father, please translate. He said, I saw the rabbi's burning eyes, but I don't know what he said. My father basically was brought up in America. So he was not born here, but he was brought up here. Could not speak in such very difficult terms. And he tried to ameliorate it, and he said that if you have to understand that sometimes you have to live up to the responsibility of being a Jew, understand that this you have the moment that you could have the opportunity to save so many Jews. And he put it very much softer way. Baron turned to my father and understood what he had said. And he says, Nein, nein, Mr. Bunim, Zacht Ibe was ich hab gesagt. My father, of course, with his das turn and was Chachamim, knew that that was what he had to do. Repeated exactly the words to Morgenthau, that if in this critical moment that you are not willing to come and help save Jews, you are worth nothing, your position is worth nothing, one Jewish life is worth more than all the positions in Washington. Morgenthau put his head down on the desk and did not say a word for 10 minutes. And he picked up his head and he said to Rabbi, he said, I am a Jew. I am here to help save these 300,000 Jews. You come back this afternoon and you will have that license.
That Kachava?
That's not the way the story ended, but that's not important.
Okay, very good.
It ended where one of the people from the secular Jewish organizations in Switzerland went to Hitler to tell him about the deal, killed the deal. But that was not true about
it. I mean, it never went through?
Never went through because what? Sally Meyer, who was the representative of the Joint Distribution Committee in Switzerland, went and told Hitler about the deal and told him what Hitler wanted to do.
Sally Meyer went to tell who?
Hitler.
He was talking to Hitler?
He had a relationship.
But he's a Jew?
Yes.
But
he didn't go directly, he had his people that were they had a relationship with him.
That's unbelievable. But a Jew should be visiting him. Okay, could you make any final thing, but something like to finish off the summary of what you said and what the experience was like?
I mean, all I can say is that what to see, to live Gedola Shinushi Yosin Mimuda, to live with a Rosh Hashiva, with a Gadol of such stature, you can gain more from serving him than even from learning from Torah, from him, but seeing his everyday action, and understanding his love for every Jew, his love, his feeling to save every single Jew that he could possibly save, whether it was a physical saving of Jews during the terrible Holocaust, or was helping to save Jews when they were in trouble in any place in the world. That was the most important thing to him in his life. And of course, Torah, of course, was the foundation of everything that he did. And Torah, building of Torah, and revolutionizing the whole situation of Torah in America, which was really something that he is responsible for the growth of Torah in all of America. And therefore, it is really a tremendous force to have had a relationship with such a tremendous Gadol, to live with him, to see him, to be with him, and to have part of doing things with him. This is a force that shall always be in my mind as one of the most important things in my entire life.
Thank you very much. And because then the Santa Yon's all the Mashiach to came by him.